I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. My guest today is Jabari Asim, a former editor and columnist for The Washington Post and the editor-in-chief of The Crisis, the journal of the NAACP. His 2007 book, The N-Word, Who Can Say It, Who Shouldn't, and Why, was acclaimed for its important and trenchant observations about race in America. Asim's latest book is a collection of essays that continues his exploration of the complex dynamics of race, in particular around what he calls the narrative combat that white and black people engage in as they live and encounter racial inequality from vastly different perspectives. The book is called We Can't Breathe, On Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival. Jabari Asim joins me when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us today. My guest is one of the most important African-American intellectuals of our time. Jabari Asim is appearing tonight at the Enoch Pratt Library to discuss his latest book, a collection of essays that explores subjects both personal and political. From what he terms the narrative combat that attends the conversation about race in America to the tension around respectability in the fight for racial justice, to reminiscences about a childhood filled with books and the what he calls robust and nourishing masculine ambience with which his father filled his home as he and his siblings grew up. Jabari Asim is a former editor and syndicated columnist at The Washington Post and the editor of The Crisis, the journal of the NAACP, a position he left last year. He's now on the faculty of Emerson College in Boston, where he's been for the past 9 years. His new book is called We Can't Breathe, On Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival. You can join us on the Facebook page at WYPR, where we are streaming our conversation, and a little later we'll take your calls and comments via email, Twitter, and the phone. Jabari Asim, it's good to see you again, sir. Welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Because you made Baltimore your home for a few years.
That's right. I was here from 2008 to 2010.
Yeah, yeah. And we were glad to have you and glad to have you back. We talked the last time you were here about another one of your six books for adults called The N-Word, Who Can Say It, Who Shouldn't, and Why. I was very moved by that book. I thought it was a really compelling and persuasive argument.
Thank you.
This is a group of essays that do take up some of the same themes, I mean, in terms of the conversation about race. Let's talk about this notion of the narrative combat that's going on about race. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's a phrase I came up with. Originally, I was struck by something I'd read. It was Richard Wright, and I can't remember the specific text now, but he talked about much of the conflict between blacks and whites being a battle over the nature of reality. You know, how is reality defined? And that always stuck with me. And then later, I encountered Toni Morrison's concept of the master narrative, which is less race-based but more power-based. People in power want to maintain their power, so they control the narrative. And then in terms of oppressed people, I thought, it occurred to me that what oppressors often do is get between oppressed people and their stories. And that's where that creates a lot of room for distortion, deception, dishonesty, et cetera.
Because when it comes to the differing notions of what reality is, you quote a scholar named Ronald Fair, who talks about the lie they call democracy, the insidious myth that they call fair play, this vicious thing called the American way of life. I mean, it sounds like you're just dismissing the whole canon of at least the platitudes that people put forth about what it means to be an American, what the American dream is, etc.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess another thing I'm sort of bouncing off of, the poet Muriel Rukeyser has this notion where she says the universe is not made of atoms, it's made of stories. And I'm a storyteller, so I was drawn to that concept. And so that's another thing that I'm looking at. So, I mean, I have a healthy appreciation for stories. It's how I make my living. But at the same time, I'm respectfully skeptical of all of them, including my own. And I think that's a way of looking at stories. What is the purpose of the story? How is it manipulating my interest or my investment in what's going on? And I think we have to look at that even in terms of our own country. In fact, in some ways, I would argue that that is patriotic. It's constructive engagement with the very stories that make up the fabric of the American identity.
Yeah, I mean, it's incumbent upon all of us to question the mythology that we've all grown up with and understand, and also to understand how we understand it, given our own individual perspective.
Yes, and that's another thing that I look at. I look at how I personally respond to these notions. Even sometimes when I'm aware that it's a false notion, and I still allow it to circumscribe my behavior sometimes, because as a human being, I'm highly imperfect. So I can say, okay, I know this to be a false notion, but at the same time, I'm conforming to it. I'm responding to it in a way that's probably not the best possible way.
Right in the very beginning of the book, in your first chapter, which you call Getting It Twisted, you talk about street-level skepticism is one thing, but a collective willingness to accept the lie of American exceptionalism is another thing. So this collective willingness to accept this notion that America is somehow exceptional. There's been a long-standing argument about
sure.
whether it is, whether it's a good thing if it is or a bad thing. But when collectively communities of color, African Americans in particular, accept this lie of American exceptionalism, what's the consequence to that?
Well, the consequence is we don't go as far towards achieving actual equality as we might otherwise, because we're hesitant to criticize. So there's this there's certain aspects of governance that we could probably refer to as they, but we refer to it instead as we, because we're so invested in it. We've so bought into that idea. And I think part of that is because we want to be comfortable. And it's more comfortable to sort of blindly accept without question some of these myths instead of dissecting them, unraveling them, saying, well, what's at stake here? And so we are aware of the misinformation campaigns that have often plagued African-American experience in this country. But at the same time, for periods of time, we sidestep them, we ignore them, and we think, if I just put my nose to the grindstone, if I just work harder, if I just wear a coat and tie, if I do this and that, it will all be okay in the end, and the possibility of the police pulling me over and executing me becomes very slim. But again, that's just buying into comforting myths. It's not the reality. And on some days, we're willing to admit that. And other days, we just can't confront it. It's just too immense and disturbing to wrap our minds around.
Yeah, and the centrality of comfort is something you write a lot about. You quote Dr. King, who said, you know, the biggest problem that he had in places like Birmingham and Selma and Montgomery wasn't necessarily racism, but the problem that white moderates had with they preferred comfort over radical action to end injustice. They were disconcerted by the discomforting consequence of protesting.
Right, and I think that's as much of an American response as a white liberal response. I think we all do it. I was just reading a middle school biography of Claudette Colvin, who was the first young woman thrown off a bus in Montgomery, Alabama.
Before
Rosa Parks. And one of the things she talks about in the book is how angry so many black people were. Her own classmates who said, "We had it pretty good. It was pretty peaceful."
Yeah, don't rock the boat.
You've rocked the boat. You've stirred up trouble where there wasn't any trouble. And her argument was, actually, there was quite a bit of trouble. We were willing to overlook it for the sake of comfort.
We get a lot of calls on this program when I have conversations like this about race from what we might term as well-meaning white folks who say, well, I'm not a racist. You know, I don't live my life that way. And you talk about the black inclination, or the inclination on the part of some black people, to embrace white people at their worst, as if they would only get to know, or somehow, you know, have an intimate relationship, a friendship, or a knowing relationship with a black person, then, you know, their racism will end and it will somehow spread throughout society. But you say that's one of the myths that folks have bought into for a long time.
It's a myth, and we all succumb to it. I certainly do. You know, I used to joke with my wife when we lived, before we lived in Baltimore, we lived right outside of Washington, D.C., and I used to say to her, you know, I fear that I've become that quote-unquote cool black guy who can be invited to parties and you know, oh, yeah, Jabari, he's a cool black guy, so he can come, right? And there's a certain comfort in that, because it grants me access to places that maybe if I were perceived differently, I wouldn't have that access. But that doesn't make it right, right? So I think we're always kind of wrestling with this idea of how much can we say in mixed company? And until we're willing to have those really uncomfortable conversations. And they're mutually uncomfortable. It's not just the idea that the white liberal is being challenged. It's uncomfortable for me to have to raise the subject, right? So it's not a joyful experience for me either. And I acknowledge that, you know, that there is some inherent difficulty in these genuine human interactions that we need to have.
We talk a lot on this show about this uncomfortable conversation about race that is so necessary to have. Where in your experiences are the places that people really are afraid to go? Where are the places that are just that nobody wants to touch for fear of offending, for fear of being outed as a closet racist or an implicit racist, or mm-hmm. or their implicit bias being outed? I mean, where are the places that this conversation really needs to happen?
It's both past and present. So, for example, when we're talking about history, we still have well-meaning liberal intellectuals who will say about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, for example, or perhaps it was a romantic coupling, you know, and it's like, well, she was 14, he was in his 40s, she was property, it's not a relationship between peers capable of consent. But I've seen liberals really kind of just contort themselves to try to find a way to make that a positive thing, or just to defend it. And then on a contemporary level,
and let me just tell you,
sure.
Because it's an almost an understandable, I don't agree with it by any means, but it's an almost understandable impulse to want to say Thomas Jefferson was a decent guy. He's the father of the country. He wrote these documents that are founding documents. So, how do we understand this impulse to elevate people like Jefferson and Washington and other slaveholders who did start the Republic?
Yeah, well, I think, we want to be absolutists. And I think what we have to say is actually Thomas Jefferson was capable of genius. No one should suggest otherwise. Anyone who reads the Declaration carefully can say there are some brilliant things in here that perhaps we hadn't seen before. A natural outgrowth of Enlightenment thinking, the best of Enlightenment thinking, not the part that's tainted with warped delusions of supremacy, is there. I think we can say that. And I think because we get so amazed by the genius that's there, that we wanted to apply to everything that he did.
Yeah, right? And I'm sorry, I interrupted
you. No, it's quite all right.
That's the past, moving the conversation.
Yes, here's a contemporary example. I think there are still liberals who say things like, well, if the unarmed black man hadn't done anything, why did he run? Why didn't he just comply? Cops are good people. They're just doing their jobs. You know, it's a very bland, innocuous, and willfully blind assessment of situation, even when we're looking at video, you know, and it's like...
It says otherwise.
Right.
Quite clearly.
Right. And how could you not understand any African American's impulse to run? It's the ultimate fight or flight scenario when you're pulled over by a policeman, because the weight of history and the weight of the present is present in the interaction.
You talk about Richard Wright's argument that the Negro was America's metaphor. That was true when Richard Wright was writing this however many decades ago. And does that remain true now? I mean, is it changing? Is it evolving?
Well,
and in what way is it America's
metaphor? You might make the argument that African Americans are not solely America's metaphor, because one thing we have to acknowledge is that the nature of racial interaction is not so binary as it once was. So when we have these conversations, we are obligated to open them up and say, we're not just talking about black people and white people. We're talking about Latinos and Asians and indigenous people, et cetera. So depending on how you look at it, there you can make arguments that different groups of people have functioned at times as America's metaphor.
How do you feel about the phrase people of color, speaking of Latinos, mm-hmm. Indigenous Americans, Asians, etc. Is the lumping in of everybody who's not Caucasian or not considered white helpful, neutral, negative?
Well, I think it certainly depends on the context, and there's certainly some political utility in people of color coming together around their common experiences. And I often use it. I think it's a convenient but imperfect term. The reason why I use it is because I don't have a better suggestion. But what I think it is an improvement upon is we were often referred to as non-whites before people of color became popular. And the last thing I want is to be defined by what I am not.
Or what you are
right?
not. Right.
So I think in that respect, people of color is an improvement. It's probably not the best possible phrase, but I don't know what that phrase is.
Jabari Asim, the book is called We Can't Breathe, On Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival. We'll have more with Jabari Asim when we return from a quick break. And when we do, we'll take your calls, questions, and comments at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, that'd be swell. It's @TomHallWYPR. And as I mentioned, we are streaming our conversation live from Studio A on the WYPR Facebook page. Stick around. We'll be right back. Booker T and the MGs, Green Onions. For those of a certain age, we know that tune. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. My guest today, Jabari Asim. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation about mobilizing voters in this crucial midterm election. I'll talk to Nike Robinson of Black Girls Vote, Sam Novy, he's with a group called Baltimore Votes, and a political consultant and activist, Catalina Bird. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. Speaking of voting, today is the last day you can register to vote in the election on November 6th. Now, if you choose to vote early, the week between October 25th and November 1st, you can register and vote on the same day. There's a referendum on the ballot, actually, that if passed, would allow registering and voting on Election Day in the future. But for this election, you can only register and vote on the same day if you vote early. And again, if you are eligible to register, you can register today and vote either early during the early voting or on Election Day, November 6th. If you're just joining us again, my guest is Jabari Asim. He's a former editor and columnist at the Washington Post for 10 years. He was the editor-in-chief of The Crisis, the NAACP's magazine. His latest book is called We Can't Breathe, On Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival. You are welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's go to Michelle in Harford County. Michelle, welcome to Midday with Jabari Asim.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to make a comment, I guess. I'm from Harford County, Maryland, which didn't have a lot of African-American families or Black families living in it. And the school I went to, there were quite a few Black people, but I didn't look at them as Black people. My mom did not raise my sister and I to see color. I played on a softball team. This is early 70s. And I invited my whole softball team over to come to my birthday party. And we actually had parents from the Black families calling saying, are you sure it's going to be okay? Are they going to be okay? Are other people going to be okay with my, daughter being there? And that's the first time I really thought about the difference in how horrible it was. To think that to send your kid to a birthday party and you're worried about what other families would say about that. And the other thing is my daughter's dating a mixed African-American boy and or Caucasian. And I was talking to one of my girlfriends and she said, guess what? Samantha is having a colored boy sniffing after her. And I was like, a colored boy? I said, what are you talking about? Is he Hispanic? And I knew what she was saying, but it just shocked me that this good friend of mine would do that. And then, I said, Maggie's dating Javon. The pictures you see on Facebook, that is her boyfriend. It's not a friend. And she goes, oh, no, that'll pass. And it just still shocks me that in today's society that it shouldn't shock me.
Yeah, well, Michelle, thanks for your comment. And Jabari Asim, it shouldn't shock her. I mean, it's sort of out there all the time. You write... When trying to wrap my vocabulary around blackness, I find myself reduced to opaque mumbling. I want to say that I may not be able to describe exactly what blackness is, but I know it when I see it. The vocabulary around this, I mean, obviously using the term colored is offensive for a gazillion reasons, but it's not easy to come up with the right rhetoric.
Yeah, I think it's a challenge, and I mean that's one of the things that I admit to, in the book. You know, I'm someone who thinks about this a lot, and most of the time in very protective ways. But if I force myself to pin down exactly what it is, it becomes very difficult. And I think one of the reasons that it is difficult is because on a non-cultural level, when we talk about race, we say, well, it's a social construct. It's not biological. Reality, and I think that's what happens when you leave the language of the laboratory. This is what people are made of. This is what they're constructed of, and we look at how they behave. Then it gets really difficult. I mean, it's fascinating, but at the same time, there are no easy answers.
You write about Black Lives Matter, and you say that one of the great contributions that movement has made is to question the sanity of returning again and again to request protection and justice from a government that will not save us.
Yes.
What is the alternative then? I mean, is the government a thing that is able to be abandoned? I mean, where does that go?
Well, I think there's such a thing as constructive opposition, where we can point out defects in how things are governed and suggest alternatives. And I do think that, you know, there are multiple strategists who are much more qualified than I to speak specifically about policy. But it's very fundamental. So, for example, Black Lives Matter activists, I've often very, very eloquently, they've pointed out, we don't need another civilian oversight board. We don't need more community-oriented policing. You know, we keep going back to these same solutions that aren't really our solutions and clearly don't work.
Yeah, right? It's the efficacy part.
Yeah. So I mean, that's one of the elements that I've gotten out of this current movement, that they continue to make that point, and they make it very well.
And you draw this lineage, I mean, in Cicero and Little Rock and the civil rights, sort of the monumental civil rights episodes, you know, in the 50s and 60s, it was white people, enabled perhaps by law enforcement, who didn't stop them or didn't do a whole lot to stop them, that were the progenitors of the racial animus and hatred and violence. And now that maybe has calmed down a bit, although there's certainly more than enough Klan rallies happening.
And Proud Boys.
Exactly. Charlottesville, Virginia,
yes.
Et cetera.
Yeah.
But now it's the police themselves in the 21st century. The intolerance for perceived black impudence, the surrogates for those mobs in Cicero, Illinois, and Little Rock, Arkansas, are now the police themselves.
Yeah, I think there's sort of, I mean, I would sort of push forward a notion that they're sort of like safety valves. You know, they allow the steam of resentment, of racial resentment, to be released from white communities. They can do it because ordinary citizens can't follow black girls down the street as they did Elizabeth Eckford in 1957, hollering, you know, epithets at her. But that frustration is still there, that racial resentment is still there, that fear that something is being taken away from white entitlement. And so I can't help but suspect that that's part of white silence, white liberal silence around police brutality, that the police are in fact performing a service, a psychological service, on the behalf of the masses of white Americans.
I can imagine that a whole bunch of white liberals would contend that there has not been a silence about it, that there's been a substantial level of outrage among white folks towards the targeting, what is certainly seen by many as the targeting of young black men in particular, just in the same way that people, you know, want to elevate Jefferson, I mean, as the genius who couldn't be all bad, people want to believe that the police are trustworthy, you know, and this notion that it's a few bad apples, what do you make of that? I mean, does the evidence suggest that that's true, or does the evidence suggest, for example, here in Baltimore, under a consent decree with our police department, there's, you know, been this long Justice Department report that said here's a million examples of unconstitutional policing. When someone says, oh, it's not every police are generally good, it's just these terrible guys over here.
Yeah, I think it comes back to silence, right? Because we say there's if you look at the video and you see one policeman choking Eric Garner, and the rest of them aren't choking him, but the point is the rest of them aren't doing anything. They're not stopping. They're not applying CPR. What makes them good? By what standard are they the good apples?
The book is called We Can't Breathe, On Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival. Its author, Jabari Asim, is with me here in Studio A. Our number on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. You can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page as well. Let's go to Don in Parkville. Don, welcome to Midday with Jabari Asim.
Good afternoon. Some of the topics that have been discussed remind me of when Eric Holder was Attorney General and he said we're cowards about race because we don't want to talk about it. And I thought about, at the time, I thought, really? You really want to have that conversation? Because in a lot of ways, since the rise of Trump, it seems like that conversation has been taking place and revealing, frankly, the depths of real white hatred against African Americans and other people of color. So, you know, with that sort of background, the basic question I have is, what is the conversation you want to have with white Americans? Not just liberals, but just broadly, because from, you know, as a white man, you know, I hear things, and I know this sounds almost absurd, but I'm not sure African Americans realize the depth of hatred that exists out there among many white Americans for African Americans.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Don. I appreciate it. Of course, the age of Trump, you know, is an asterisk about everything.
Yeah. I mean, I would reorient it. I would reorient the question just a little bit and suggest that what's more important right now than a conversation, say, between whites and people of color is a conversation between whites and other whites. I think that's the conversation that needs to be held first, so that that kind of confrontation, that kind of painful but instructive engagement can take place. I mean, the common analogy for it is the good-hearted liberal says to me, you wouldn't believe the conversations that I overheard at Thanksgiving. My grandfather's a racist. My aunt's a racist, et cetera, et cetera. And that disclosure is of no value to me because it only confirms my own suspicions. So I want to say, take that back to your community. And instead of marveling over it, actually challenge it.
Have a fight at Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Have an uncomfortable Thanksgiving
right.
day. Let
yes.
everybody go to their own rooms after dinner and not speak to each other. But then maybe people will realize, here's why we're not speaking to each other.
Yes.
Because, I mean, if Uncle Fred said some racist things, let's call Uncle Fred out on that.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
That's hard for a lot of folks to do.
Yeah. I mean,
keep the peace. You know?
Yeah. I totally empathize.
Yeah. You write about an historical figure, Sam Hose. He was a laborer in Georgia, and he had a confrontation with a white man, and the white man died, and Mr. Hose was tortured to death by a lynch mob in 1899. Mm-hmm. W.E. Du Bois witnessed what happened in this town, that they took this man's knuckles and toes and they put them in a butcher shop window to intimidate black people, mm-hmm. clearly. Right? Mm-hmm. So Du Bois sees this, and you mentioned that he calls it a red ray which could not be ignored, and that the modern day equivalent of that is the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're seeing things now on the internet, vis-a-vis police brutality and other things, that heretofore we just weren't seeing. It just wasn't easily accessible.
Right. And it's so visceral. It's so in our face that it challenges all of us. You know, how are we going to respond to this? What can we do as human beings? And so what we get is the equivalent of Sam Hose in the butcher shop again and again because of the technology.
I want to talk a little bit about fatherhood. You write
okay.
very movingly and poignantly about your own dad and your growing up, and about President Obama's contention about black fatherhood. He gave a speech in Chicago on the South Side just 6 months after he was inaugurated. This is a little bit of what he said.
The family is that most important foundation. And we are called to recognize and honor how critical every father is to that foundation. They are teachers and coaches, they're mentors,
and their role models. They are examples of success and the men who constantly push us towards success. But if we're honest with ourselves, we'll admit that too many fathers are also missing. You and I know this is true everywhere, but nowhere is it more true than in the African-American community. We know that more than half of all black children live in single-parent households. Half, a number that's doubled since we were children. We know the statistics that children who grow up without a father are 5 times more likely to live in poverty and commit crime.
President Barack Obama speaking about 10 years ago in Chicago. He got a lot of pushback from that speech and from comments, similar comments he made some other times. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, even just listening to it now, you know, it's like you can't talk about the number of fatherless households doubling in a generation without talking about disproportionate incarceration at the same time. You know, so it has elements of disingenuous. It's partly disingenuous even then, because we have to look at all of these other factors. But I do think I don't want to decontextualize his speech. He does praise African-American fathers who are doing well. He criticizes African-American fathers who are doing poorly, which I think is fair.
Mm-hmm. Your own dad, you write, and this is just such a beautiful turn of phrase. You said you grew up in a household in which an ambient masculinity as robust and nourishing as pot liquor enriched the atmosphere. A young boy needed only to take a deep breath to inhale the wisdom in the air. Mm-hmm. Is your dad still alive?
It's 89.
Yeah.
It's 89, yes.
Because you write about how you were moving him out of his house and,
yes.
And the memories that mm-hmm. Engendered. But your experience very different than the experience of Barack Obama, whose father, of course, was absent in his life.
I wonder if
your perspective, and I grew up with my dad, and whether our perspective is just different because our dads were so fundamental to our daily life.
And I acknowledge that. I mean, one of the things I look at, one of the things that struck me in Obama's memoir, he doesn't just talk about the absence of his own father. He talked about the absence of black men in the community in Hawaii where he lived. And so one of the things I reflect on is my father was present. He was home every day. But even if he hadn't been, there were so many other black men, many of whom were doing excellent things, that I could have modeled myself after any number of men.
And a lot of black women, too.
Absolutely.
A community in which everybody is keeping an eye on everybody else's kids.
Yeah, yeah. It's almost a cliche, but in many respects, it was an urban village. Yes.
Yeah. Outside of St. Louis, right?
Yes. Yeah. In St. Louis.
In St. Louis.
Yeah. Inner city, north side.
All right. We're going to take a little break and we'll come back. Jabari Asim is my guest today. He's an associate professor and the director of the graduate writing program at Emerson College in Boston. He's a former editor and columnist at the Washington Post. His new book is called We Can't Breathe, on Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival. We'll have more with Jabari Asim when Midday returns after a quick break. You can join our conversation at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Here's a little music of Ramsey Lewis as we go to a break. Welcome back. A little music of Lee Morgan, that Sidewinder. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. If you've just joined us, Jabari Asim is my guest this hour. He is the author of 15 books for both adults and children. He's also a poet and a playwright, a former editor and columnist at the Washington Post. He grew up in St. Louis. He's the director of the graduate program in the Department of Writing, Literature, and Publishing at Emerson College in Boston, and the former editor of The Crisis magazine for the NAACP. His latest book is a collection of affecting and insightful essays called We Can't Breathe, on Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival, in which he explores a variety of issues, including police violence, black masculinity, and cultural representation in the arts. among many other topics. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's go to John in Catonsville. John, thanks for your call, and welcome to Midday with Jabari Asim.
Oh, thank you. My interest was piqued when you said your guest worked for the NAACP. We know that's the acronym for the Advancement of Colored People. I had two questions. You spoke earlier how preposterous it is to refer to African Americans as colored people. Well, why won't they change their name? Also, I know they've done really great work in the past, but what types of advocacy are they currently engaged in to help the community? I never hear anything specifically about what they do.
All right, thanks, John, for the call. Of course, you were editing the Crisis, a great magazine, the Journal of the NAACP, for 10 years.
Yeah, it was a great privilege to edit the Crisis. And so I worked out of the, for the most part, out of the national office. I think that's a really good...
Which is right here in Baltimore.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's a really good question about colored people. But again, I think it's difficult because if... We haven't yet settled on what we're going to call ourselves, I think. And, you know, there are limitations to each of those terms. At the same time, I think there is some historical resonance and some value in holding on to the old terms. I think the difficulty is, though, and it's the difficulty that the organization is encountering, is when you bring that old language to the table and your constituency is getting younger and you need to reach young people, that may be a turnoff. Just the very idea of the name may be turning off some young people. That might be a stop sign as far as they're concerned. That might be a compelling reason more than any other to seriously consider adapting the name to match the tenor of the current times. What the NAACP is doing now, I can't speak with authority about that, not being an officer or a member of the national branch. But I do know they're involved in many particularly legal battles about discrimination in school districts, police brutality, et cetera, across the country.
I know the NAACP very involved in the race between Doug Jones and Roy Moore in Alabama.
Yes.
Teamed up with the ACLU and, you know, did a big mobilization of voters there to defeat Roy Moore. So, I think, you know, there certainly are, in a way, they're sort of identifying those. They're picking their battles.
Yes, yes. They are ongoing campaigns, I think it's fair to say.
And of course, we wish the best for the local branch of the NAACP here in Baltimore that have had some internecine disagreements, and they do have a new president, and so we look forward to the organization sort of getting back on track. Your final essay was really one of the most compelling, I thought, in the book, and you talk about the limits of respectability, this impulse to be sort of accepted or considered respectable by folks who aren't African Americans, and how that can shape the political arguments and personal action.
Right, and I mean it comes from the civil rights movement, where you had, you know, marchers in their Sunday best, and it made sense. I think it was politically useful as a strategy at that time to always be as squeaky clean as possible, because it was really important at that time for African Americans to seize the moral high ground. But one of the things I argue is that this really isn't a struggle about morality, and we kind of have to, you know, shift gears a little bit there, because the reality is that if Trayvon Martin had been dressed in a suit and tie, he'd still be dead. If Tamir Rice had been in his Sunday best, he'd still be dead. If Sandra Bland had been dressed different from however she was dressed, she'd still be dead. And I think we have to acknowledge that reality and say, let's think less about how respectable we need to be and be more forceful, articulate, and strategic about the things we actually need.
There was a gentleman yesterday who goes to work every day, an African-American gentleman who goes to work every day in a suit and tie. Didn't happen to be in a suit and tie when he was entering his luxury apartment. I think it's in Chicago.
In St. Louis.
St. Louis, yes. And a white woman who lives in the building said, oh, you know, who are you? You don't belong here. I understand that the consequence to that white woman is that her employer has disengaged her from that company, whatever
yes.
it was.
Yes.
But what should the consequence be for that? What should happen to white folks who are calling the police because there's a bunch of black men barbecuing in a park, or you know, we hear these stories. Just there's a constant flow of these stories, and they're ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't think anything will happen to those people unless other white people decide that it's a problem, and it's not a problem for white people.
But what should happen? So, what should the white people? What should white people be saying to that person?
They need to be educating themselves and saying, you know, can you see yourself? What is the reality here? This is a black man entering his. This is a no brainer. What is it about the situation that
he's got a key to the door?
Right. Right.
I mean, I know it just sounds so simple, but
you know, black people can fuss about that. We can post about it on Facebook, but unless it is seen as a genuine affliction on the part of white people, nothing will happen.
You write about appropriation. Mm-hmm. And you say that it used to be appropriation when it comes to art and culture. It used to be about like literally just stealing stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, the sort of antique notion of sampling, I guess.
Yeah.
But now it's an appropriation of the black experience.
Right.
And in particular, black pain.
Exactly.
So talk about that a little bit.
Well, yeah, I guess the earlier example would be, say, like Pat Boone singing Little Richard songs. That's appropriate. That's one kind of appropriation. And it has, you know, one of the important elements
of it.
And
that, by the way, was never pretty.
but he profited from it.
Absolutely.
Which is the other issue, right? This is like, it's sort of like taking money out of Little Richard's pocket and putting it in Pat Boone's. And that is still an issue. But what I see, and I don't necessarily agree with this, but what I see critics of appropriation pointing out in particular right now is black pain. They don't want anyone who's not African American to make any art that comments on black pain, which I do think is a problematic position. And also, I don't know. I'm less wound up about appropriation because I'm a storyteller. I'm a writer. Writing is essentially appropriation. I mean, I say in the book, you can take my sentences apart probably and identify every single influence I've ever had. It's hard to shake them off, and in some instances, I don't want to shake them off because it strengthens what I do. So I'm not as quick to just judge people because their work bears obvious influence.
Yeah, you bring up the example of just last year in 2017, there's a white artist named Schutz, I forget his first name.
Dana, it's a woman.
Dana Schutz, who did a thing for the Whitney Biennial, big, you know, mm-hmm. infamous, or famous, not infamous, famous, you know, art show, international art show, about Emmett Till, called Open Casket. Yet there are a lot of black artists who really protested vehemently against that, saying that it just wasn't her right to use that historical event as the fundament of her artwork.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I think an artist should be free to respond to any event with their art. And I think it's up to us as perceivers of that art to then make a decision. I can say, well, it's a lousy painting. I didn't like, and I don't think it's a lousy painting, but I'd rather see that kind of criticism. Like, she tried, she didn't do a good job. The other part of it I had a problem with was artists preventing me from seeing it, from taking it out of public view, saying no one should see this. As a perceiver of art, I want to make that decision for myself. I want to look at it and say, oh, it's great, or I agree, it's terrible, but I want to make that decision.
Jabari Asim, the book is called We Can't Breathe, on Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. We're streaming on the WYPR Facebook page, and you can send us a tweet if you'd like to as well. You talk about the need to redefine morality itself, that our old or our current notions of morality simply may not suffice for the current moment.
Right, and I don't know what the new definition should be. But I'm just really hesitant to cast everything in terms of good and evil, or this is immoral. I don't think that appealing to conscience or moral suasion is the way to persuade people to be more just and to be more fair. I think it overlooks the very powerful element of self-interest that motivates most human decisions, all of us.
Because if there is an American morality, and maybe what we all understand is an American morality, you point out maybe it's incumbent upon black intellectuals, if not everybody else, to point out the sort of fraudulent underpinnings of the so-called American morality.
Right. If we're going to have an American morality, it has to begin with a daily acknowledgement that we're on stolen land. right? That everything that we're benefiting from is a direct result of genocide. I mean, if we're actually going to be moral, we have to start there. And that's not even, that's usually not even a part of the conversation.
So is reparations then the only place to go to start the conversation about the new morality or the new understanding of morality?
Well, reparations speaks to certain kinds of commerce, both financial and otherwise. And I probably wouldn't start there. I'd probably start with just trying to arrive at some acknowledgments of our imperfections. All of us. Start there. Let's say we're all on uneven ground and we've all contributed to its unevenness in varying degrees. And let's talk about all of them.
Is it fair for me to describe you as a black intellectual? Is that limiting in any way? I mean, I really do believe you are one of the four or five voices that I point to, at least in my little brain, as doing some of the most important thinking and writing about the black experience in America. But is it limiting to, in that in any way?
Well, thank you for your kind words. But yeah, it is limiting in some ways. I mean, sometimes I would like to be regarded as an American writer, an American intellectual. As inherently flawed as that label is, it does speak to inclusion because I want to be part of the larger conversation and not just the conversation that has direct implications for African Americans.
You write at the very end of the book that you don't think love can conquer injustice, but you think strategy has a fighting chance.
Yes.
What are your notions about what that strategy could entail?
Well, one of the things that I'm comfortable with as a writer is I pay attention and take notes. I don't strategize. Chinua Achebe said, writers don't give prescriptions, they give headaches. So my role is to identify the afflictions and then defer to people who have the skills to actually come up with actual strategy. And my point is, I think those people are out there. I think they're everywhere, and we're not listening to them.
And what is the role then of the white liberal who is who resonates with the message, who wants to see change, who wants to move the needle, and who wants to make a positive contribution?
I would say listen and share. You know, listen to what other communities are saying to you, then take that, become an envoy for constructive engagement, and take that to your own communities and share what you discovered.
You write about, again, W.E.B. Du Bois in The Souls of Black Folks, saying it's with Shakespeare, or I sit with Shakespeare,
and he
winces
not. Right.
You know, so we... But when, again, to this question of a black intellectual, an African-American intellectual, as opposed to an American intellectual, I mean, it's a good thing to have as many folks throwing stones in the soup as possible.
Yeah, and maybe it needs to be a global conversation.
Yeah. You're writing about growing up and reading, and you have written children's books, and I want to make sure folks understand that you have 9 children's books. Mm-hmm. But when you were a little kid, there was only 1 or 2 books that even featured black children in the books, the books for children.
Right. And one of the things that, at least for me, is I didn't necessarily miss seeing myself in those books because I could always turn away from the book and look out the window. And I saw myself everywhere.
Jabari Asim, his latest book is a collection of essays called We Can't Breathe on Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival. Jabari Asim will be speaking about the book tonight at the Enoch Pratt Central Library. It's part of their Writers Live series. The event starts at 6:30. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. It's wonderful to see you, sir, and congratulations on this collection of essays. It's terrific.
Thanks so much, Tom.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Nike Robinson of Black Girls Vote, political strategist Catalina Byrd, and Sam Novy of Baltimore Votes join me for a conversation about increasing voter engagement and getting people to the polls in the midterm election. That's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. Again, Election Day, November 6th. Early voting starts a week from Thursday, October 25th, and that runs for a week. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. On behalf of the entire Midday team, we appreciate your tuning in. Thank you so much. We will see you tomorrow, and we're going to go out with a little soulful strut. This is the Young Holt Trio. Have a great day. We'll